over by the red ditch in here, and they used to, and some sugar mills were taken over. And they went even further. They established in many areas of Cuba, so net workers' councils were established in Cuba in 1935, in that period in there. So it seemed that there was every possibility that under the impulse of the proletariat, that it would be possible for a revolutionary party, a revolutionary socialist party in Cuba, to move into power and to carry out the bourgeois revolution which Cuba needed. But here we come into a complication, which I'm sure most of you are expecting, and that's the perfidious role of Stalinism. Now, the Cuban Communist Party became Stalinized shortly after, about the time that the American Party, Communist Party, became Stalinized, so that by 1930, it was pretty much under the domination of the Stalinists, that is, the Stalinist foreign policy. And in that 30 and 31, they followed a policy which paralleled that of the Communist Party in other countries, which was extremely ultra-leftist. They called for armed uprisings in Cuba, and they actually engaged in a few adventures of that kind in the early 30s. As a consequence, the Communist Party took quite a setback, even before Machado fell from power because of its extreme ultra-leftism. It took a setback and lost a good deal of influence. But it began to make a comeback after Machado fell, after 1933, as the workers began to move in greater force and power in Cuba. But in 1934, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who some people know by the initials FDR, concluded a pact with Stalin, peaceful coexistence pact with Stalin. And part of one of the items that was involved in this pact was quite clearly the Communist Party of Cuba. That was one part of the package deal. Because the Communist Party in Cuba very shortly shifted over to support of Batista. And they pictured Batista as a man of the people, which he was, since he had risen as a bartender and odd job worker in various parts of the country, and then he studied shorthand and became a stenographer in the army, and a man of considerable capacity, especially in military politics. So they pictured him as a man of the people and a true Democrat, and threw all their forces behind Batista. And as he moved into greater and greater power, they took a share of the responsibility of governing the country, their responsibility namely being to keep the workers from getting too much out of hand. Batista was a shrewd politician, and he was quite willing to accept the help of the CP. And he utilized the CP for many years in the 30s to contain the working class and prevent them from moving into a prominent ruling position or a ruling position in Cuba. Now, he also made some concessions to the workers. Concessions were made under Batista. There were some wage increases, especially to a rather thin layer, the workers in the big monopolies there, the electrical monopoly. And the electrical trust was one place where some concessions were made. And he even went farther. In the 1940 Constitution, there is written down many concessions of a very progressive character, such as aid for the workers, unemployment. You can't be fired from a job in Cuba, for example, without just cause, and you can carry your cause to a labor court. And they actually enforced this under Batista. And there were other provisions in this 1940 Constitution that were quite okay so far as they were written in the Constitution. I mean, he made some concessions to the workers. But the role of the CP in supporting Batista led to a decline in its influence. And gradually, the CP was replaced by a different type of trade union leader than the CP. It was replaced by the type known as the Mujahalistas, after a man named Mujal, who began as a member of the Communist Party, but under Batista became more and more simply a Batista agent, until that's what he actually turned out to be, an agent of the capitalist state in Cuba, in charge of the trade unions, and the trade unions were harnessed to the government so that it became impossible for the workers to move through their own unions. They would have to reorganize them from top to bottom in order to move through that channel. So this, in general, was the role of the of Stalinism in Cuba. And as you can see, it boiled down to a very simple business, which was to prevent the workers from moving into a position where they could carry out the bourgeois revolution that Cuba needed. Now, just a word about the Trotskyists. They were a minor current in Cuban politics. The split in the Cuban Communist Party over the issue of Trotskyism versus Stalinism, that is, between permanent revolution and socialism in one country, if you pose it on a theoretical level, this occurred in the early 30s. That was even before about the time that the CP began to move leftward. I would say 1929 and 1930, insofar as I've been able to determine it. I'm not too familiar with all the exact details. They were a minor current in Cuban politics, but well known. Their main base was in Oriente, especially around Guantanamo. That's the city, it's not the bay. We always think of Guantanamo as the bay and the American naval base, but there's a large city in eastern Cuba named Guantanamo. They were well known there as militants and as figures in the labor movement. By 1935, there were a few forces moving in the direction of the Trotskyists. One of them was an outstanding figure by the name of Antonio Guterres, who is now one of the heroes in Cuba. They named the electrical plant in Havana after him just last year, I think it was last summer. Antonio Guterres. He was moving in the direction of Trotskyism, and he was a sort of figure that Castro is considered today. That's the kind of figure Guterres was. A man very much concerned about Cuba's fate, and determined that it could only come in a revolutionary direction, and searching for organization and the mounting of a movement that would bring Cuba out of its impasse. In 1935, he was going to leave Cuba and go to Mexico as an exile in order to operate from abroad. It seems like every one of these movements at a certain stage has to go abroad and establish a base among the Cubans who are in other countries in order to gather funds and get organized. But as his trip was planned, they were betrayed, they were captured, and they were killed by Batista. Guterres was killed. And it seems that the Trotskyists never recovered from this blow. Periodically, the CP in nearly all countries has been able to go through big declines due to very often to the perfidious types of policies that they carry out. But then they recover due to the influence of the Soviet Union, which continues to remain an attractive center. And when new forces come into political life, they turn towards the Soviet Union as a great example of a successful revolution, and the Stalinists are thereby able to recoup their positions. Whereas the Trotskyists are not able to do that, since they have to base themselves purely on independent positions that are developed by the workers themselves through their own experience. And this has been repeated many times, as repeated in Cuba. Trotskyists existed in the 30s, up until the 40s. We were in touch with them during the 40s. Some of our seamen comrades who were on the runs in that direction used to see them regularly. They were reinforced by some refugees from Germany who escaped from Hitler's terror. They lived in Havana for a while, but they remained a minor current. And what finally happened to them was that as Castro's movement developed force in 1953 to 1956, some of the leading Trotskyists in Cuba joined his movement. And they became very good members of the July 26th movement, but not so good as Trotskyists. We lost touch with them after a while. I knew one of them in particular. He used to come up to New York to collect funds, and he would tell me some of the experiences he was having with the Castro movement in Mexico. That was when they were in exile. And he was one of the figures who was in the Granma expedition, and one of the 12 who escaped up onto Pico Turquino. But we tried to look him up in Cuba in recent times, and apparently he's become meshed into the government apparatus, and we're not sure exactly what he's doing, but so far as being a Trotsky is concerned, he's very quiescent. And he's not a prominent July 26th figure either. All right, now, if we sum up these various class forces in Cuba, the bourgeoisie, the peasantry, proletariat, and these various tendencies, it would seem that there was a seemingly hopeless situation because there was no available force to lead the bourgeois revolution that Cuba needed. But the fact was that a great vacuum was being created in radical leadership in Cuba, tremendous vacuum. And it was this vacuum which the July 26th movement filled. So I'll just spend a few minutes now on the July 26th movement to give an indication of how, of what this movement was like. Now, the July 26th movement was led by petty bourgeois figures who became interested in politics while they were on the Havana campus. And the Havana University has an old tradition of radicalism and of political activities. I can remember when I was going to the university a long, long time ago that Havana University was always in the news, and some of us at the University of Utah compared the political activities on our own campus very unfavorably with those that were occurring in Havana, because politics on the campus I was on was mostly fraternity faction fighting for posts and privileges on the various things that were available in student politics, whereas in the University of Havana, the students were all engaged in national politics, you know, and big issues and big deals, and they're out there fighting in the streets, and that seemed to us a very fine thing. We couldn't convince many people around the University of Utah that that was the correct course. Follow that example. All right, those are the kind of leaders that came to the July 26th movement that formed it. They emerged from the orthodoxal movement, which was a split off from one of the democratic parties in Cuba. And first they began as the leading exponents of the views of the orthodoxal party, but Castro gradually moved away from their positions to establish an independent position, and finally he split from the orthodoxal movement and founded the July 26th movement. As a matter of fact, he founded the movement before he split. He split about 1955, and he founded his movement in 1953. Now, they operated on one main principle, and this was the most interesting feature of this entire movement. This main principle was a necessity for a violent overthrow of the government, which is quite legal in Cuba. They advocated it, they organized for it, they fought for it, and they staked their lives on this one main principle. And in relation to all the other forces in Cuba, they had this one main proposition they put on the table in case of alliances or in case of collaboration. That whoever they worked with had to agree to this one principle, to overthrow Batista by force and violence. And they didn't go just by words. They demanded deeds. Who have you had shot, you know? What have you tried to overthrow? Where are your guns? What guns did you capture from the soldiers, you see? What money are you giving us in the mountains? They cash on the barrel head. That's the only thing they understood, the only thing they talked about. And they just disregarded words. They were very good at looking past what people said to what they did. They became real experts at that. That was its main principle on the political level. On the organizational side, they were just as interesting, because what they did was to form an organization that was already known in political history. And that was an organization along the lines set up by Auguste Blanqui, who was a great revolutionary figure in France in the past century. I can't remember offhand now when he actually began his organization, but it was probably in the 30s, 1830s. And he spent about 38 years in prison because of his views on this question. What he did was set up a highly conspiratorial organization of an elite of revolutionaries who were bound by iron discipline, completely iron discipline, no ifs, ands, or buts. Was just one figure in control of the whole organization. That was Auguste Blanqui. He gave the orders, he determined the dates of everything they did, everything went according to what Auguste Blanqui said, no ifs, ands, or buts. A highly disciplined organization. And they operated on the theory that if they would seize a government, say like City Hall, that by seizing it and then broadcasting the news to the workers, that the workers would respond by rallying to their cause, and they could then sweep out the government and put in a workers' government. And they tried that a few times, and the first few times it created quite a sensation, but the workers, not knowing what was up, stayed home, you see. So that the cops came in and captured the whole force and sent them to prison. And after this happened two or three times, Auguste Blanqui himself came to the conclusion that this was not the best way to organize, that it was necessary first to spend a lot of time preparing the ground in a propagandistic way. But his organization went ahead under its own steam and created more situations like that, and each time it happened, they'd arrest Auguste Blanqui and put him in prison. So he spent about 38 years in prison. But to show you how prominent a political figure he was, it's held by some students of the movement that if Auguste Blanqui had been out of prison, the time of the Paris Commune, he was in prison at that time, and he was already an old man then, but that if he had been out of prison and had been functioning in that Paris Commune, he would have known the correct steps to have taken to have established that commune so that it was not overthrown the way it was. There were all kinds of errors that the commune made that August Meinke would not have made with his experience, but he was in prison. All right, this was the kind of organization that was set up by the July 26th movement and operated along the lines that August Meinke had worked out for his organization. So that was a very interesting development that in modern times something like this would appear in Cuba of all places under Castro. In ideology, they picked up where the Cuban independence fighters had left off in 1895 and 1898. That is, they began with a bourgeois ideology, bourgeois democracy, all up and down the line. And that's what they were fighting for, was bourgeois democracy, or a bourgeois program. Very briefly, it was first of all for an agrarian reform. That was their biggest point in their platform, agrarian reform. The establishment of political democracy, that is, end the tyrannical dictatorship and establish political democracy. The independence of Cuba, freedom from American influence and establishment of national independence, true independence. And finally, the industrialization of Cuba, its complete industrialization, the rounding out of its economy. These are all bourgeois demands. There's nothing wrong with them being bourgeois demands, that's just what they happen to be. The whole point of the theory of the permanent revolution is that these demands can only be carried out by the workers being in power, establishing their dictatorship and then carrying out these reforms. But in Cuba, it turned out that there was a petty bourgeois force that was that advanced these demands, advanced them very vigorously and in action, not just in words. All right, so we come to this. These observations I'd like to make. That in Cuba, the bourgeoisie were incapable of carrying out this bourgeois democratic program. We already know the reasons for that. According to the theory of the permanent revolution, this program could only be undertaken by a proletarian dictatorship. That was the theory of the permanent revolution as it was developed in 1905 and as it was held after the October Revolution up to in the early 1920s. But in this case, in Cuba, this program was espoused by a petty bourgeois political formation, and they carried it out, although the permanent revolution excludes that possibility. Because we know that the petty bourgeoisie, from all past historic experience, are incapable of carrying out such a program because they split on big questions like war or revolution, part of them going to the bourgeoisie and part of them towards the proletariat. So we have to ask the question now, was the theory of the permanent revolution verified in Cuba, and if so, to what degree? So let's look just a little bit more closely at exactly what happened in Cuba. Now first of all, the big steps that were taken by the July 26th movement when it came into power. First of all, it carried out the agrarian reform. It carried it out in two ways. One, it gave land, individual plots of land to the peasants. And this was all over Cuba this occurred, but especially in Oriente, in the mountainous areas. And they also carried out the agrarian reform by taking over the big estates and converting them into cooperative farms, and which began to employ thousands of workers, and all the year round by varying the crops, where before there'd only been maybe 10, 15, 20, or a couple of hundred workers employed on growing a very few crops. That's on the agrarian reform side, a very thorough and deep-going agrarian reform. Then they went further than that. They began to put controls on industry and even more. First of all, they began to nationalize the industries that were held by the Batista followers and Batista politicians. They took those over and nationalized them, and then they began to move towards other nationalizations, but always under the impulsion from the United States. Now, you're all familiar with what occurred there in regards to nationalizations, that they reached such a point that by the end of 1960, in October to, August to October of last year, they had completely taken over everything in Cuba of any size whatsoever, all the major industries, and especially the sugar industry, the key industry in Cuba. They took these over completely, and they began to institute a planned economy. In other words, they shifted from purely bourgeois measures, they carried out a prolonged class struggle, and they finally reached a point where they began to take socialist measures. That is, measures that are socialist in principle. The complete nationalization of industry, its organization by the state, and the introduction of a planned economy. All right, so in this respect, we see an exact fulfillment of the permanent revolution. In other words, according to the permanent revolution, a dictatorship of the proletariat is established, and it opens up a class struggle that exists over a longer or shorter period of time. As time is not specified, it can be a longer period or a shorter period. But this dictatorship opens up this class struggle, and first it carries out measures of a bourgeois revolution. And we're all familiar now with what those measures are, but the impulse of the revolution is so great, or the class struggle becomes so deep, that they have to go beyond these simple measures, and eventually they begin to take socialist measures. And by taking these socialist-type measures, they begin to alter the whole character of the state so that it changes from the base that it had previously when it came into power to a completely different kind of state. Now, just mention here once more, since we didn't go into this too much yesterday, that in this process, the very institutions of the state are changed. From what they were in the beginning under the bourgeoisie, they finally end up into a completely different type of state institution. In Cuba, it's quite clear what the new state institutions are. They are the Revolutionary Army, the Rebel Army, the Revolutionary Police, that's a strange combination, Revolutionary Police, the Militia, the Unions, which have been reorganized from top to bottom, the Defense Councils. We don't know too much about those, but we do know that they're being organized by the tens of thousands clear across Cuba in every city, every village, every part of Cuba. The Defense Councils are being organized. And on Technical Advisors Councils, which are organs that are set up for workers to have a voice and part control in management. A whole series of these different organizations and institutions are set up which, conducting a planned economy, committed to a planned economy, constitute a different, qualitatively different kind of state institution from what they had at the beginning under Batista. So all of this is exactly as predicted in the permanent revolution. This whole pattern of a continuous revolution is exactly as predicted in the permanent revolution, except in one of the main points. The very point that's familiar to the permanent revolution, that it was not done under a proletarian dictatorship. It was not done under the guidance of a revolutionary socialist party taking power. That didn't occur. So it seems that we're in a position that the permanent revolution was both confirmed very brilliantly and not confirmed not so brilliantly in this key point, because that is what's special about the permanent revolution, that this is done under the governing government of the proletariat through their Revolutionary Socialist Party. All right, so that gives us a problem now. We just can't say that permanent revolution was confirmed all in every jot and tittle and let it go at that with this big gap in there. And on the other hand, we just can't say, well, it's been put to the test and it's lacking in certain respects, so there's a big question mark over the theory of the permanent revolution and leave it like that. We can't do that, at least from a theoretical viewpoint. Theory demands its own rights and its own logic. So you have to account for this deviation. Now, we have found in our study of Cuba that this deviation is accounted for by new forces on the international arena which did not exist at the time the permanent revolution was first projected in 1905, or as it was carried out in 1917. I'm sure that some of you at least are quite familiar with these new forces, but just let me indicate them now so that we'll have them before us on the table to make this theoretically rounded. These are all on the international arena. First of all, the deviation was due to the fact that capitalism as a whole has entered an era of decline. It's quite different. Capitalism today is quite different from what it was in 1905 or in 1917. I mean world capitalism. And this is shown clearest of all in the very center of world imperialism. That is right here in the United States, the decline of American world power, relatively speaking. It's still plenty powerful. But relatively speaking, it has taken a whole series of defeats and setbacks which could not have been dreamed of in 1905 or even in 1917 or in the early 20s. So that Cuba finds itself in a world situation quite different from that visualized at the time the permanent revolution was projected. Number two, and this is just as important, is the strength of the Soviet bloc. There was no Soviet bloc in 1905 to exercise an influence. There was no Soviet bloc in 1917 to exercise an influence. But today, there is a Soviet bloc of tremendous power, next to imperialism in power. And what's especially important about it from a theoretical viewpoint is this, that a planned economy exists in the Soviet Union as a living example, so that every country, the leaders of all countries, no matter what class they are, can see this living example in front of their eyes. And even if it's distorted, even if it's not as good as it should be, still, it stands there. And from a theoretical viewpoint, it stands as a programmatic point, planned economy. You see, a program can begin with words and on pieces of paper, and then it can be transferred into a living organization, people who carry out this program, and finally becomes an institution, or a number of institutions, governments, economies. It takes that form in its final stages. So here you have a revolutionary socialist program in the form of a planned economy standing as a living example. That didn't exist in 1905 or 1917. So this has an influence on every country. Then there is the rise of the colonial revolution, which occurring all over the world gives a special impact to and force to every sentiment in every part of the world, outside the areas where it's most active. For example, the Algerian Revolution has been conducted for 7-8 years now against France. In Cuba, the Algerian Revolution is known backwards and forwards, and the example of the Algerians is held up every week in Cuba as to show what the Algerians could do against a major power, imperialist power like France. Well, think what the Cubans can do against America. In other words, the struggle is not hopeless no matter how big the power is. And they're in touch with each other, the Algerians and the Cubans. They send missions back and forward. And the same is true with other areas where there is a colonial revolution. So the colonial revolution has a direct influence on Cuban politics. This is not well known in our country, where we're isolated and kept behind several kinds of walls and curtains. The next big item which we must list is the default of Stalinism. See, in 1930, Cuba could have had its revolution, its bourgeois revolution, which could have then gone over in 1935, 33, 35, which could then have gone over to a socialist revolution. But due to Stalinism, this did not occur. But there's a certain payment that occurs. It's not only a payment of a setback and of a defeat, but there's also a payment that Stalinism itself has to pay, even though it seems to recover from it. The end result is that it creates a vacuum. This vacuum then opens up possibilities for new leadership formations, especially revolutionary socialist formations. So that when you have a formation coming along like the Castro leadership, which occupies this vacuum, it's manifest that its tendency must be in a revolutionary socialist direction if it is to succeed. It has no other choice. It can sell out and create another default. The vacuum becomes bigger. But the main tendency is towards the building of revolutionary socialist leaderships throughout the world. And formations like the Castro leadership, considered over a long range viewpoint, give us the greatest hope, because what they have done is bypass Stalinism and open up completely new perspectives for us. So these are the main determinants that have occurred on the international arena, which make it necessary for us to make a certain modification in a minor extent on our theory when we check it. So let me try to summarize now, since I've already gone over the main time. The theory of permanent revolution, as we saw yesterday, was drawn up as a result of experience. It's in the main sequence of revolution from feudalism to capitalism to socialism. We have not yet had the experience of going directly from capitalism to socialism, but we have had the experience of the permanent revolution. And this was drawn up as an expression of the experience of the 1905-6 revolution in Russia, checked back with the experience of 1848 to 1850 under Karl Marx. So that this theory was drawn up as a result of experience in revolution. And that's one of the most main things to note about it. Now, within that experience, which it expressed, the theory of the permanent revolution allows some variations. And it's not just a mathematically perfect formula, which has got to be filled out with every single number in the formula. It allows some variations, particularly in the beginning of the revolution. In that sense, even the permanent revolution, although it is an arithmetical expression of Lenin's algebraic formulation about the democratic dictatorship of the proletariat and the peasantry, still, even within the permanent revolution, there's a certain algebraic formulation in regards to the beginning of a revolution. And if you study it very carefully, you'll notice that Trotsky leaves open the possibility for some variance in the beginning of the revolution. In 1922, the Fourth Congress took up this special point, which is only a very small special point in the whole theory of the permanent revolution, and it foresaw the possibility of other regimes than the dictatorship of the proletariat beginning the revolution, not ending it, but beginning it. You see, just to begin this process of the permanent revolution in a country like Cuba. Part of the following of the July 26th movement moved in the direction of the counter-revolution, that is, towards the bourgeoisie and towards Wall Street. And you could